You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Not a good morning. I don't get a good morning out of you today.
Do I normally say good morning?
You say good morning, Bill. If there's a spring in your step, I might get a good morning. But this is Thursday morning. I'm just guessing. I was putting it out there that maybe the manometer is not at Reaganing. This might not be a Reaganing kind of week. Could it be TR? Is it Teddy Roosevelt? Maybe. Could be. Maybe something in the middle, like an Eisenhower.
We are bottoming out this manometer. It's ugly, nasty.
But the perennial question is it worth it for Gorsuch?
Well, I think that here's the problem with that, Bill. It's within the realm of possibility that Trump will cause Republicans to, lose the presidency, lose the House, lose the Senate. And even if you believe that Supreme Court justices are the end all and be all of politics, and that the ends justify the means as long as they give you Supreme Court justices, this thing could be, you could end up having a situation where Republicans have squandered this amazing opportunity where they had the Senate, the House, and the presidency very quickly. I think they're going to lose the House. I don't think that's a bold statement at this point. And if they lose the House, then Trump will probably be impeached by Democrats. I don't think he'll be removed. I mean, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but what the hell? We might as well go there, right? Because the bar for the Senate conviction is so high. I don't see that happening. But very possible that, in 3 years or 4 years, Republicans don't have any power and are discredited. And the bench, this great bench that conservatives had, unlike Democrats, is tarnished and muddied up, and basically you have Republicans in the wilderness for a period of time, and Democrats could get two or three or four or five Supreme Court picks, you never know how these things are going to work.
Well, that's definitely the darkest possible scenario a Republican could
offer. Well, that's kind of where I'm at this morning, Bill.
Well, but I do think there's a range of possibility here. I mean, we all the way to a special prosecutor could come out and say, there are some eyebrow raising stuff. I mean, sort of like a Comey statement. There's a bunch of stuff here that didn't look so hot, but it doesn't rise to the level of criminality. Or maybe Paul Manafort did something, but it doesn't rise to Trump.
The problem, though, I agree. The problem, though, is that Trump has, I think, very unwisely declared war on the intelligence community and on the media. That is not a smart move. And there are leaks that continue to come every day. And on top of that, Trump has demonstrated no ability to correct things. And so there's no reason to hope that things are going to get better or settle down based on that.
Well, that's...
Yes, I agree. I agree it's possible things could settle down. But why would we have no evidence to support that hypothesis?
Well, I don't think anything's going to settle down quickly. I mean, because the leaks will keep coming. But that's only bad if you care about governing. If you want to, say, pass healthcare reform or you want to pass tax reform, having that be a constant shadow of everything gumming up the works, I could see where that might bother you, and you being someone who cares about conservatism, You, Matt Lewis, might care about that. If you read, you know, what I wrote last week, Real Clear Politics, about Trump voters, and also, and if you think I'm being, you know, hoity-toity liberal in the bubble, go read Charlie Sykes in the New York Times, conservative from Wisconsin, who basically said almost exactly what I said. Trump voters don't care about governing. They care about making liberals mad and making media heads explode. So Trump fighting this is like Trump fighting everything else. Like that is satisfying.
Yeah, but you could have said the same thing about, you know, Richard Nixon supporters, you know. I mean, I know the world has changed, and so it's probably not wise to assume that the Nixon template is gonna, you know, carry over, but you could have said the same thing about his supporters.
Well, I think that contingent of Nixon bitter enders, you know, was about 20-25% of the country. There was enough significant erosion in the Republican base that Republican politicians could go to Nixon and say, look, the jig is up here. So far, you know, Trump's Gallup ratings at 38, which is only a mild drop from the 46% he got in the election in the first place. The 38% number is not likely voters. It's all adults. So that drop is probably even smaller from the voting population. The approval rating amongst Republicans, last I'd seen, is still above 80. So, you know, maybe it drops, maybe, but
we are, I mean, if we are going to use the Watergate analogy, this isn't 1974. This is 71 or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're early on in this process. What does the world look like after Republicans lose the midterms and are slaughtered and lose the House?
More fighting.
What's
more appeal for
like?
Trump to fight, which is what these folks want. They want the fight. They don't care that much about actual policy wins. Making people like me angry and go ballistic on Facebook is a satisfying response. So this is more just, you know, when Trump says it's me against the world, Trump voters say it's us against the world. And right. I think that can sustain for a while.
Well, I think it could sustain for a while, but, you know, when Republicans lose and they're out of jobs and Democrats prepare to impeach the president in the House, and frankly, I think that they probably have enough grounds right now that they would impeach him. Like, I don't know that we need anything else. If Democrats controlled the House, I think he would probably be impeached at this point. And, you know, I'm just saying, maybe I'm pessimistic today. Maybe I'm down in the dumps. But, you know, people turn on, people are fickle. And right now, Donald Trump still is a hero to some of these people. But, you know, it's like in The Godfather when Vito Corleone says, it's true that I have friends in the police, but they wouldn't be very friendly if they thought I was involved in things that that they deemed to be, you know, whatever. Once Trump is not perceived as a winner, once it looks, you know, will the rats abandon the ship? In other words,
and that's what I thought after the Iowa caucus, but I was mistaken.
Maybe if he had, I mean, who knows? It's impossible to say. But if Ted Cruz hadn't helped him and Chris Christie hadn't helped him win New Hampshire, he would have been 0-2, and maybe we might have seen that play out. I don't know.
I mean, there's been a lot of losses. I mean, he's lost health care, he lost the travel ban. I mean, it's been one humiliation after another, and you don't see that bond breaking. I think this level of political polarization and cultural polarization has been building for so long. It's not this; it didn't just happen overnight, and it's not going to end overnight.
Right, but my theory is Republicans lose the House, lose the presidency, and then Democrats end up controlling things for a long time. It's possible that Donald Trump will keep 35%, 40% of loyal supporters who do back him and do see him as this martyr or as this courageous guy. He could have 35 or 40%, and Republicans could still lose everything electorally.
Sure. I mean, the loss of the electorally in 2008.
No, I mean they could lose the presidency, and the and be in the, like, Republicans lost in 2008, but they weren't, you know, with George W. Bush. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think. I mean, he had Katrina, he had Iraq. There were scandals, you know, sex scandals, and not with George W. Bush specifically, but you know, in the House and whatnot. But I don't think it had the same flavor as this. Mainly because, you know, conservatives and Republicans, like kind of mainstream conservatives and rank and file Republicans, stuck with the team. Like, they weren't, I don't know that, I mean, Trump is a Democrat who was never conservative, and he's an interloper. So it's a different dynamic.
But McCain was always seen as not one who was of the, you know, the conservative proletariat, if you will. You know, Trump fosters that cultural affinity in a way that McCain did not and Mitt Romney did not.
So they actually repelled it.
Right. So I don't know if it plays. I mean, look, we're getting obviously very far ahead of things. But I want to raise one point in your assumption, which is, if Democrats win the House, then Trump gets impeached automatically. And I don't even know if that's true. I mean, I might give it higher than 50-50 odds. And I agree with you that you got enough evidence already that it wouldn't be hard to draft the articles of impeachment today.
And then all they need is a simple majority too.
In the House.
In the House.
I mean, you
in
need
House
more to convict, to of course.
A lot more to convict.
Right. And because of that fact, and because the average age of the House Democrat is well over 50, I believe. These are people who were around for the Clinton impeachment. They remember that impeachment backfired politically. And because they will know that conviction will be very difficult. And even if you get to that point, I mean, you'd have to, you know, you wouldn't impeach on, you know, January 10th, 2019. You'd start an investigation anew, which would probably take several months. You then have, you know, your impeachment vote, probably in, you know, mid to late 2019. Then you'd have to move to your Senate trial. That's probably going to be in, you know, early 2020. If you succeed, then what have you done? You've given Mike Pence a leg up, a year to prove himself in office until 2020. And you might say, well, that might be like, you know, Ford after Nixon, but Ford made the political error, maybe the right thing for the health of the democracy, but the bad thing for himself in pardoning Nixon. Pence might not do that. You might get more of a situation like Calvin Coolidge after Warren Harding. Harding died, but Teapot Dome blew up after that, and Calvin Coolidge was seen as the guy who cleaned house. Pence could be the guy who cleans house and coast in 2020. So there's a lot of reasons for Democrats to say, wait a second, maybe this is not the right thing for the country. Maybe it's not the right thing for us politically. And if there's a hesitation there, man, will you see division on the left? Because obviously the base on the left is going to be demanding impeachment immediately. So I don't know if you get this, you know, perfect situation from a Democratic perspective that Trump's on the ropes and Democrats are fully united if Democrats win the midterms. There's still some tricky political decisions to be made at that point.
Just imagine this, though, Bill. Republicans have the president, the Senate, and the House, and more state legislate. You know, they've got
most of the governors,
majority of attorneys general, more state house seats than ever, or since Coolidge or whatever. And it's possible that they will not repeal or replace Obamacare, that they will not do tax reform, that they will not do any of the big agenda items, and that they will lose the House. And I think that they do, you know, I don't think they could convict in the Senate which means you've got a battered and bloodied president. You don't have Pence. You have Trump. I just think that the opportunity that Republicans had and the way it's going to shake out, I mean, could there's a very good potential or possibility now that it's going to be Gorsuch may be the one. I mean, like you asked me at the top of the show, like, is Gorsuch enough? And the answer is no, if that's it. Like, if he's the only thing and they lose everything, including their reputations. And, I mean, I think it's entirely plausible that it plays out that way right now. Now, who knows? You know, what was it, a month ago, he was Reaganing?
Because of Gorsuch.
Yeah, but...
Well, you know, Noah Rothman at Commentary Magazine wrote a piece along these lines. Basically, he's been pretty anti-Trump the whole way through, and laid out you have Republicans have the biggest political opportunity in 100 years, and they're going to blow it because they nominated a game show host to be president. I mean, as you laid out, I mean, you know, they control almost every aspect of government possible, and yet can't seem to deliver. And, you know, so, and part of that is hiring someone who's, you know, emotionally and psychologically damaged to be president of the United States. But it's also because as a party, and I think this speaks to what you wrote in Too Dumb to Fail, you know, since the beginning of the Obama presidency, there was never any intellectual spade work done. There was never the effort to say, okay, when we get in power, this is exactly what we want to do. This is what would fulfill the conservative vision for what America can be. You know, even today, I mean, you're hung up on Obamacare, which is just out of spite, practically. I mean, yes, there's some conservative beliefs about free market and whatnot, but as far as like a priority list, if I ask you, I'll ask you right now, if up to you, you know, if you're looking back in October of 2016, and you say, okay, we're actually going to win everything. You know, one of the top three things I really want to do would really show the world what conservatism can do. I mean, would healthcare bill be at the top of that list?
No, I think they should fix it. I think the top of my list would be probably something they don't even want to do, which is entitlement reform.
Right.
You know, I mean, that would be at the top. Fix Social Security.
Also politically
and
difficult.
Medicare. No, incredibly difficult, as we saw with Social Security and George W. Bush. But it's a mess, and I do think, you know, that Too Dumb to Fail might end up. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to look back at that book, which as you and I both spent a lot of time on.
See, what you should do. I don't usually give you career advice on the show here, and I know you got a bunch of stuff cooking, but clearly. The book to write now is Too Dumber to Fail.
Yeah, the sequel. Dumber. No, it's... I don't know that I have any appetite for that. When I wrote... I poured a lot into that, and the Republican Party promptly ignored everything, every piece of advice I gave them. It was a little bit dispiriting, to be honest with you.
Vindication.
It's, you know, it's the kind of thing that I don't know that I would wish for the book to be vindicated. You know what I mean? Like on the country, if not the movement.
Well, how much of what's going on now? How much is the decision for a special prosecutor, the general support that's getting from the Republican caucus? How much of this is people in Republican Washington saying? What we really wanted all along was President Pence, and here's our chance to get it.
Well, I think that deep down, I mean, you know, Paul Ryan would, you know, Charlie Sykes, we would all prefer Pence. I mean, Pence would actually be, I mean, Pence isn't my favorite politician, but he's a real conservative. We could definitely say that. But I think the odds of getting a President Pence are not good. I mean, I don't think Trump. I mean, Knock on wood. Before we tape this, we heard that Roger Ailes had died. We could talk about that next. But I think the only way you get a President Pence is if Donald Trump were to expire. Not that any of us are hoping for that. But I think that's probably the only way you get a Pence. I think the odds of, I mean, maybe Trump resigns, but it goes against everything we know about Trump.
I can never see Trump resigning.
Right. I'm in the middle of this Roger Ailes documentary. Roger Stone documentary. Get Me Roger Stone on Netflix. Have you seen it yet?
I haven't, and I have a general feeling of Stone, which is that he is far less relevant than he proclaims to be, and the documentary is only part of creating this mythology of Roger Stone. I choose not to
feed it. That's part of the documentary. That's actually a theme of the documentary, or a subplot, is that he may not be as, yeah. But I'm reminded when I watched the documentary of the Roy Cohn philosophy, which is like, always attack, never give up, never admit defeat, never admit mistake, never apologize, never quit. I mean, like, that's basically their ML. So if Trump doesn't pass away, if Trump, and by the way, I mean, he is preserving his energy by not exercising, so he very well could live to be 100. If he doesn't pass away, if he doesn't resign, I don't think he gets removed, even if he's impeached. And I don't, so then he runs for re-election, and I think probably loses. You never know. I mean, I guess it's plausible he could win re-election. But even then, Mike Pence is still not the president. It's Donald Trump.
No, so, I think he's only president. I mean, in my mind, Trump is the greatest narcissist that's ever walked the earth. And being in the Oval Office is like attention heroin, and he can never break that addiction. I mean, no matter how, I always hear things like, oh, he just wants to be loved. Like, if you want to be loved, every decision he has made up to this point would be very different. It's not about being loved. It's about being in the center of the spotlight. Yeah. And you know, so it doesn't matter if you're on the verge of being impeached. You're the fight lives on. The drama continues. The reality show has another chapter to it. So I can't see him walking away.
The ratings are huge,
right.
Actually.
Right. So, but
I was on Anderson Cooper's show Monday night, and it was it beat Fox, it beat Tucker, mm-hmm. and it, I mean,
well, Fox is making this strange decision, man. Not that I'm watching live, I'm just seeing clips on Twitter that you'll see every other network is focusing on the scandals and. You know, Fox, we talk about the Clinton Foundation.
They've got this huge problem, right? They've got the same dilemma that conservative commentators in general have, but it's even more acute, right? So if Fox talks about the scandal, then they're hurting Trump and they anger their base viewers. If they don't talk about it, they talk about something else, they're out of the zeitgeist, and regular sort of average Americans who might watch Fox are going to flip to CNN
to see
the news.
I feel Roger Ailes wouldn't make this mistake. Roger Ailes would know enough about TV to say, this is the story. We're going to stay on the story. We're going to give, you know, the pro-Trumpian take on the story, but we're going to stay on the story.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Although this is a challenge that he didn't really have to confront as much. I mean, I guess he did with Bush. I have to think back to how, I guess they talked about the Bush scandals, but in a sort of more of an apologist manner. But yeah, you're probably right. And I just want to be clear. I hope that I didn't conflate the names earlier and that people may be freaking out around the world. It is Roger Ailes who apparently has died, right?
Yeah. No, you didn't conflate the names.
Roger Stone is alive and well,
yeah.
And he's got a documentary out, a documentary about him on Netflix, which I've only watched half, but is quite good so far.
Well, speaking of Roger Ailes and his passing, obviously, even though people on the left, you know, scorned him for years, it's totally not a happy occasion when anybody expires. And
I'm sure there will be some celebrating on Twitter.
That is what social media is for inappropriate
people.
comments. But I think when anybody dies who's a public figure, it's an opportunity to assess their legacy and their mark on society. And I always, you know, Slate used to have a, and I think they still do, but it used to be more formal, a tradition of, you know, honest obituaries, you know, unsentimental obituaries.
Right.
And, you know, Roger Ailes was one of the singular forces shaping the Republican Party and conservatism for at least 25 years, starting with the start of Fox in the 90s. Not to mention his contributions to, you know, the Nixon presidency and, you know, George H.W. Bush. I mean, he was involved with the Willie Horton, you know, attack strategy. You know, he defined political combat. He defined how to caricature the left. You know, if when we talk about the political polarization today, you know, he is one of the main reasons for that. And obviously it took the Republican Party places to at times successful. You know, perhaps you would not have had a George W. Bush or a Donald Trump without what Roger Ailes built. But as you wrote in your book, there were some heavy, heavy costs to that, too.
Yeah. Well, I would say a couple things. One, John Ziegler has made the case that if you look at what has happened to the Republican Party since Fox News, it has just empirically been a bad thing for the Republican Party. Like, the Republican Party did much better before Fox News, which is a little bit ironic. The second thing I would say is that I'm trying to think of the name of the head coach of Penn State.
Paterno.
Joe Paterno. I keep looking and all I see is Sandusky, but Joe Paterno, who had a sterling reputation for decades, he's been brought in scandal, you know, fairly or not. Like, John Ziegler, the aforementioned John Ziegler, has been a defender of his. But you get this guy who had a great career, he's embroiled in scandal, and 6 months later he's dead, right? And I just wonder if Joe Paterno was still coaching for Penn State, he might still be alive. And I wonder about Roger Ailes. Like, I don't know if it's the scandal or if it's the losing their gig, but I suspect if it wasn't for this scandal, if Roger Ailes was still at the helm of Fox News, he'd be alive today. I mean, there's no way of knowing that, right? But I think that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I mean,
and I think it's a psychological phenomenon that's pretty observable.
No, I suspect a lot of people stay at the Supreme Court till the very last moment because there's that fear if you step away from the work, you know,
you'll be dead in 6 months.
Body atrophy. And the one thing, I mean, obviously, you know, Roger Ailes obviously tried very much to create this political battlefield. So from his perspective, all that's a great, great success.
I wrote a piece for Roll Call that I was very proud of that got basically no attention. But I think I was the only one to really point out, I think it was July 19th, 2016 was the day the music stopped, or whatever,
right.
The day the music died. I mean, that was the day it became clear that Roger Ailes was going down and that Donald Trump was not sworn in, but that he was won the Republican nomination, accepted the Republican nomination at the Republican National Convention,
right.
July 19th.
Right.
One day that will live in infamy.
Right.
One day
and
that day says everything about the collapse of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. Roger Ailes and Donald Trump, one day.
Right. And I don't think you can, you know, separate out the sexual harassment scandal from that. I mean, it might be tempting to say, here's all the accomplishments Roger Ailes had, in the 10th paragraph point out, well, and he got ousted because of a sexual harassment scandal.
That's got to be in the first sentence, probably.
It may be, but I still can see how, in talking about it, you might talk about these things on kind of separate tracks. But
yeah, no, I think in the obituary it has to be, and you said it has to be, you know, disgraced former Fox News. I mean, I think it has to be in the lead.
But so when we were talking, I just want to make one point about this. In part because, I mean, look, you go back to 60s or 70s, misogynistic culture was so rampant, all not just amongst conservatives, but everywhere. I mean, it's saturated almost everything. And a lot of things we see being dredged up is because of how insidious all that was. In Fox world, part of the cultural combat was fighting against the modernization, fighting against, you know, political correctness all the time. And I would suggest that led to a continued permissive culture of sexual harassment at Fox.
This is an interesting point, Bill. I have observed this in general, not with sexual harassment, but in the conservative movement, there is an element of the conservative movement that views like political correctness, and they even view like onerous laws as trivial, so we don't have to observe them. Like, there are very sketchy people in the conservative movement who break laws and go to jail, get indicted, congressmen, staffers, whatever. If you delve into part of their worldview, they don't respect these rules or these laws, and therefore they don't abide by them. And it's consistent with their ideology. Their lawlessness is consistent with their ideology. It's a very interesting thing. And they sort of flaunt the rules. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Flaunt?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. I think. I think political correctness is run amok. If you like, you could use that as an excuse to justify harassing.
And even that was used to justify, you know, Trump's behavior that was exposed in the campaign. So when conservatives reflect on Ailes, I would suggest you need some reflection on not just what have we wrought politically, but what have we wrought culturally. You don't need to be a sexual harasser to be a conservative. The two things should not be intertwined.
It helps, but you don't have to.
How can conservatives say, you know what, there are people on the left that have a point when it comes to misogyny?
Totally. And I think, you know, it's one thing to talk about, you know, political correctness run amok, but it's another thing to like justify the fact that there's too much political correctness and use that to justify being a jerk or being a whatever, being a harasser, being a predator. You said, I want to say this though, Bill, you before in the pre, when we were talking before the show, and I said Roger Ailes had died, you said that's sad. And I think you're right. But you know, people say it's sad when someone dies, but I think it's especially sad because this guy, talk about blown opportunities. We're talking about blown opportunities with the Republican Party. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, had the power and the purge and the ability to make the world a better place, to use his position for good, and he squandered that opportunity in many ways. I'm sure he did some good things, but, I was just showing my kids this old Bill Cosby skit, you know, from like the 70s, where he's like, "Dad is great, give us the chocolate cake," you know. You remember that skit?
Yep.
Where like
yep.
Bill Cosby like gives his kids chocolate cake, yep, you know, for breakfast, and his wife gets pissed off. You know, and then my wife and our au pair, I hear them in the background talking about how like they could, you know, they could never watch him again because he, you know, of all the horrible things he allegedly, but most likely did, which may in fact be worse than anything Roger Ailes did. I hear my wife saying, "Well, but Matt, you know, Matt was like younger and, you know, he's a different relationship with Bill Cosby, the comedian or whatever." I just, Bill Cosby was also a guy who did amazing things. And it's sad that his reputation is now forever tarnished. And he will die knowing that he had all of this stuff, all of this power, but he is going to end up a villain.
Well, I feel like in Cosby's case, his contributions to society are separate from his what appears to be criminal behavior. There are horrible people in the universe that have contributed positive things to society. It's not, he wouldn't be the first. You know, he played a singular role in advancing race relations in the country. I mean, you can't pretend that it didn't happen. If you're going to assess the trajectory of race relations in the country, you have to acknowledge what he did in his art.
Yeah, in a way that makes it more sad.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
And beyond sort of the cultural contribution, just the craft of comedy, the craft of storytelling, he was an exceptional figure in that regard that other comedians, I'm sure, still learn from today. There are plenty of other artistic figures who were horrible people in their personal lives who we celebrate their art all the time without thinking twice. Because they were not part of a dramatic trial in the age of social media.
Also, Cosby painted himself. This is the problem that conservatives usually have. And it's not just the crime or the sin, it's also the hypocrisy. Cosby painted himself as sort of a pillar of the community.
Yeah.
Whether it came to enforcing, talking about race relations or just morals or about the family guy, the family man, you know? And so that puts himself on a pedestal that could be knocked down. I would say it's a cautionary tale because none of us are perfect. But, you know, you think about like at the end of your life, all the hard work that we do, do you want to be defined by something, the bad part of your life, you know, something like that? It's a cautionary tale for everybody. And you said sad. I think it's sad too. It's one thing to not have an opportunity, but to squander, you know, to all the good that he might have done, or in some cases he did, and to squander it, it's sad.
So to bring us back to Trump, and maybe to close this out, you would define yourself as a social conservative. You're a man of...
I don't go around calling myself a social conservative, but I wouldn't say I'm not. I mean, you know, but I don't. That's not how I like self-identify. But yeah, I mean,
you're a family values man.
Well, look, I'm very strongly pro-life. I'm sort of like in the Rubio Sass Ryan space, I think.
Okay.
I mean, we don't. Okay, here's my point. They're not Jerry Falwell, mm-hmm. right? They're not Pat Robertson. That's, you know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I think they're people who are professional social
right.
conservatives.
Well, no,
that's not how I see myself.
Right.
But I'm a,
and you're, and I know you're not, you know, you're not virulently against equal rights for gays, for example, but you certainly take your religion seriously. And
I try to, although I fail all the time.
Well,
at
we're,
it.
we're all imperfect beings.
Although, Bill, you're one of the best Christians I know. Who's in America is not even a believer.
Well, I'm more of a Mormon, you know, than a Christian. And the two are not really the same thing. If you understand your Mormon and Christian theology. But what I'm trying to get at is, Trump's strongest base of support is evangelical Christians, despite the myriad of sins that Trump engages in on a regular basis. To what extent do you think there will be reflection amongst social conservatives, amongst family values conservatives, at the end of all this to say, we went wayward here with Trump. We thought we knew his sins, but we identified him with him culturally anyway. We thought he was the imperfect vessel that God gave to us to achieve what we wanted to do on this terrestrial Earth. And you know what? That was a bad call. I mean, maybe we need to find a way to reconcile our principles with our politics in a way we didn't before. Is that happening at all right now? Or,
well, first I would say an interesting observation, which is that there were devout believers who ran on similar platforms to Donald Trump, you know, and there were people who wore their religion on their sleeve who ran on similar positions as Donald Trump. Pat Robertson's a devout Catholic. Mike Huckabee was, say what you will about him, but he was a pastor. I believe that Rick Santorum is a devout Catholic as well. Huckabee was a Baptist preacher, I think, Southern Baptist. But they all lost. They didn't get nearly as far as Trump. I think that, in a way, Trump benefited from not, you know, he didn't have the hypocrisy, because when it came out that he did or said horrible things, he could say, that's who I am. Like, I said I'm going to make America great again. I never said I was a Boy Scout. So, sort of having said that, to answer your question, no, I don't think there's going to be that kind of introspection. I think that the kind of people who would sort of have that kind of conversation are people like me and Ben Sasse and Dr. Thomas More and Eric Erickson and David French. And, you know, I think we're already there. Like, I think we're already, like, I supported Trump when he did things that I agreed with, because he was already president, right? I didn't help him get there, but once he's president, I want him to pick a good Supreme Court justice. And if he does, I'm going to praise him. But, and by the way, this speaks to my latest column at the Daily Beast, which is how will I think that there will be an attempt to, an overt attempt by the left to tarnish all conservatives and all Republicans if and when Trump, you know, goes down. And I don't think there's going to be any, like, allowance for, oh, but Bill Kristol was one of the good ones because he didn't, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think there's, I don't think that that's realistic.
What are the odds are for a 2020 Republican primary?
Do you mean a serious primary, right?
Of any sort. I mean,
Evan McMullen or somebody could run against him, but I don't think that's serious. But you mean Ted Cruz or?
That would be more serious. But you know, there's a guy running against Nixon in '72. Ashbrook, am I remembering correctly?
John Ashbrook,
is a big. And you know, it didn't get very far, but it did reveal there was some conservative discontent with Nixon, even though it didn't drag him down in the general election. And you know, Pat Buchanan, you know, maybe wasn't that serious in 1992, but he left a bigger mark on George W. Bush than Nixon suffered. So I mean, you never know how serious it could get. But do you think there's a pocket? You know, I mean, obviously Kasich's making some noise and McMullen's out there.
I definitely think that it's a high likelihood that it'll happen. Partly because there are incentives to do it. You could do it and lose and still come away, you know, with a email list and with a movement behind you, and whether you see that as sort of a self-interested Machiavellian move or if you see it as like building for the future, I think that it's better than 50% odds that's going to happen now.
All right, we'll leave it there. Hopefully, I've cheered you up in some way.
Do I seem down?
You seem
never mind what I'm saying, but just my temperament or whatever. Like, do I seem depressed?
Depressed is strong. I feel you are aggrieved.
And I think it's about right.
Aggrieved and sad. Sad.
Yes.
Sad for your country. Sad for the potential. I do feel that.
I think that's a fair assessment.
But we'll try to. We always try to have moments of optimism here in the DMZ.
Well, you know what would cheer me up is if people were to, you know, rate and review this on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show, check out Matt Lewis and the News Podcast, read your columns at Politico Mag. I'm just spitballing at Politico Magazine, Real Clear Politics, you know. These things would make me feel a little better.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong in the world that a click can't solve.
I'm also a businessman.
All right, till next week, sir.
All right, see you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.